What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! What up, meepsters? I'm Ryan Rainbro. This is Meep Meep, and on today's episode, we're celebrating 15 years of Slipknot's fourth and final album with their classic lineup entitled All Hope Is Gone, and we're doing so with a legend across many formats. He riffs, he rocks, he turns knobs. And I don't actually know if he's the guy that turns the knobs. I probably should have asked him that. I don't think he does. I think he directs the knob turner. And this is not a euphemism. This is a literal knob I'm talking about. In the studio, we're talking about superstar producer Dave Fortman, also the guitar player for Ugly Kid Joe, now, in the past, in between. The guy's rad. And he likes that word, too, rad. He's got a ratitude. And he tells us all about making this incredible album and working with a band like Slipknot. Very few people have produced Slipknot. Do you realize that? Ross Robinson, Rick Rubin, Dave Fortman. Quite a group of people to be in a lineage of. Ooh, lineage. That's a word I just thought of as I was saying it. But, you know, a lot of things are going on with this record. Okay, I don't know if you know this about Slipknot or if you've inferred it in the past, but they are always kind of on the brink of destruction. And maybe you realize that because even in the last couple of months, they are one less person from their lineup on this album. But coming into All Hope Is Gone, there's essentially two albums being made. Okay, there's All Hope Is Gone, which we know it today. And there's what is commonly referred to as Look Outside Your Window, which is often rumored to be released most recently. And when I say recently, at time of recording, we're at the 15th anniversary of All Hope Is Gone, which is August 26th, 2023, because this album was released on August 26th, 2008. And that's how math works. But the rumor is that in 2024, Look Outside Your Window will finally be released. And what that is half of the band, Sean Crahan, Clown, Sid Wilson, DJ Starscream, Jim Root, don't know a cool pseudonym for him. Not that Jim Root's not a cool pseudonym. That's a cool, listen, think about all the cool vegetables that are root vegetables. Parsnips, crushing it. And then finally, the fourth member is Corey Taylor. You may know him as CMFT, and you must know he must be stopped. They are working on a separate kind of experimental record, and I don't think it was supposed to be a separate record. They wanted to meld the two because they were feuding with the primary songwriters in the band, Joey Jordison, Paul Gray. Of course, Joey Jordison, shortly after this album, isn't even in the band anymore. And unfortunately, both of those members have passed away since this recording. But Joey was out of the band before his passing. And you can kind of see the seeds being planted as we're being told this story as to what's going on. Now, of course, Joey had other things going on as well. So I'm not saying the primary reason is that they're feuding. But I'm sure it didn't help. Okay. So much so, the band is so much so in combat with each other that the song Psychosocial, which you may know from this album, is about the band. Corey saying, I did my time, now I want out. He wants out of the band. Talking about the social politics of these psychopaths that are in Slipknot. Did you know that? Did I just make it up? Hard to say. But this album has some of their best songs of all time on it. Gematria, the opener, probably objectively their best song. Is it my favorite song? Maybe. But it's definitely their best song. And this album, I think it's important to say, is their best album. Yes, I'm sorry to be the one to tell you. I know you didn't know before. But this is the best one. Self-titled is my favorite one, and there will never be anything like it. Iowa is the big one, okay? Volume 3 is the really big one. And then this one is the best one. And then I'm told that there's ones after this. I can't confirm. But what I can confirm is that Dave Fortman tells us all about making this record, the struggles, the successes, the triumphs, all that and nothing else. And I bring that to you now.
I would say, I mean, I would have to say factually, if you look at everything overall, because Bring Me to Life is the biggest single song I've ever done. And it, of course, it's the biggest record individually I've ever done. But, you know, Slipknot is the biggest band by a mile because, I mean, these guys are filling up sheds around the world. So, that yeah, as far as like, you know, a multi-album band that's a fucking absolute rock legend, and that I would say that's the most important. Maybe for over the next 100 years, and it'll be a lot more important that I produce that record.
Well, so let's just kind of put it in context real quick. So All Hope Is Gone is their fourth record. The first two records that they do are with Ross Robinson, who they're kind of tied to for the rest of their career, mainly because of what Ross Robinson is tied to as far as an era and time. And then their third record, the one before the one you do, is done by Rick Rubin, another
huge name in production, and also another person who's two R names, Ross Robinson, Rick Rubin. And now you're talking to Ryan Rainbro about making All Hope Is Gone. So how did you get brought into the fold for this record following those other names?
The albums that connected me to really Joey Jordison. Don't listen to what people say. That's how much influence he had with that band. I mean, I didn't talk to a single other member until already when I was already like on my way to Des Moines. You know, I talked to Sean because he was talking about this other music they were writing that was, you know, he was trying to get that stuff on the record just to be more artistic and all this stuff. But the original hiring, I only talked to one dude, man, you know, and that was Joey. And he loved a lot of the part, like people, even Mudvayne hired me, you know, that I had worked on Superjoint Ritual with Philip. That had a lot of weight that I could do that album and also do Bring Me to Life, you know, the diversity in there. Joey really loved back then, you know, Happy came out with Mudvayne. And I mean, it was like, I don't know, something insane. I don't know, but I forget the stats, but it was at the time, I think Epic's longest running act of rock number one. He really liked those drums on that and the tones of it. So he was all about it. And that's really how I got into that position to do it, you know, and off I went.
Well, I know you're saying that you pretty much just talked to Joey. So when he approaches you, what did he tell you that he was looking for you to bring out of them that they weren't able to get before that they wanted you to come in and do?
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
It really wasn't sort of like he's a trip. He's not, that kind of guy. He had kind of already made his mind up, you know, and like he only made a few, like he just said he loved what I was doing. And he said, you're definitely the dude, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, all right, cool. It wasn't like, what would you bring? Or what are you going to do for this band? You know, he's pretty much just, you know, he's one of those people that he's just, him and Corey were just struck by lightning, you know, and they're supposed to be doing this, you know, if some people are just like that, then it's probably the most electrifying people I've ever met in a room. When they get in a room, I mean, these people are just fucking meant to fucking do it. And oddly enough, they were both Ugly Kid Joe fans, which is really bizarre. Like Joey knew song title. Like Joey texted me, you know, we'd be texting after he got me to do it. And I'm like, no fucking way. He's all track four, you know, ALW, Van Halen, Prince, man. Cause he was, you know, these dudes were like 14 or something when we were big. And so I believe they even saw us live in Des Moines and later. But both of them, I mean, Joey was a study of metal like nobody's business. I mean, this guy was just an incredible fucking genius. But yeah, he never, to answer the question, I guess, is he never really didn't ask me any kind. There was no questions really involved with what would I bring or, you know, what would you do with the band, blah, blah, blah. He pretty much had his mindset on him. At least it felt like it to me on the phone, you know. And that was the end of that shit. You know, next thing I know, I got plane flights and I'm on my way to go to Des Moines.
So I guess on the inverse of that, when you got approached and asked to do it, and of course you agreed to, what were your thoughts like, oh, this is what I'm going to do with Slipknot. They have this track record already. This is something I think I could bring differently to the table that they haven't been able to unlock yet. Because All Hope Is Gone is very unique in their discography. So you definitely do something.
Well, I knew that I would do the same thing I'd been doing, would be to check through what all the demos and see what else could be done to enhance all the songs, you know. And one of the biggest songs on that record is Snuff, obviously. So that wasn't on my original round of demos. And that song's like really what a producer's journey can be like, boy, you know. Insane, where I end up going, like maybe the, I think it was the first night I got there. So we end up going out, hanging out with Corey. Then me and him end up back at his house and he plays me this fucking demo on GarageBand. And I'm like, holy shit. And it was just him on an acoustic guitar. It really wasn't anything. You know, one overdub, you know, dun, 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 and that little line. And I'm like, damn, dude. And so he gave me a copy of it. And so, you know, I'd start driving out. We were going to set up the stuff out in the studio. And I called him. I said, dude, fuck. I keep driving off the road listening to this fucking song, man. We got to do this. And so we get in, start to do all the record. And the internal battle kind of started where, you know, Sean and Jim had all these other songs that were cool, but I was really into the demos from the main two writers, which are always Joey and Paul, you know? And so I was hooked on the demos. So I'm like, damn, I got to entertain this whole other creative thing. So then they got frustrated. They set up a whole nother studio in the studio owner's house right next door to the studio. So they start doing their own thing. And so I go in there one day, and this is all just to get to the bottom of this one song that I produced. This is what happens to what I'll go to, what links I'll go to. So fucking, I go next door and I see the word Snuff written on their board. And I'm like, oh, fuck no. And so I went and got Corey. I said, no, I said, fuck that. I said, come in right now. And me and him had already discussed what the vision of this thing could be, where we wanted to start small and build out in this, to be this giant ballad thing, you know, big rock song. And so I said, just lay it down, put it on a click right now and let me fuck with it. You know, I'll have something in a couple of days, you know. Everybody lived, you know, 45 minutes away. So there was always different things happening with each member. So then I started to bring everybody in one by one and I pieced it all together. Joey came in, played a bunch of stuff. You know, I asked him, I said, look, this is the one song. Like, can I move? Do you mind if I just move around your drums? And he's like, I don't know. Yeah. He's like, fine, whatever. So I should just play a bunch of shit. Let me do it. And so I Frankenstein the fuck out of that thing. Put, you know, simplified some of the beats. Went in and, you know, Jim had played a bunch of brilliant stuff. Everybody did. Everyone that came in. I mean, Jim's acoustic performance, fantastic. My God. So then I built it like me and Corey talked about with his scratch vocal on there, where it starts very small with a little guitar that builds in stereo. Then it comes out and all of a sudden it's, you know, Joey on the toms and all this stuff. And then I knew I had something. I'm like, all right, there, now I'm fucking feeling it. You know, I did a rough mix on it. And I brought Corey in to come listen to it. And that dude cried like a fucking baby, man. He was so emotional in that moment. And I said, I fucking told you, man. This is the same song. I can hear it when it was making me drive off the road from your demo. You know, so now we got something. And so from that moment on, yeah, even when Monty and all the Roadrunner people came in, they were like, damn, okay. That now... some horse shit ended up happening later on after the fucking record is already out, right? They're going to go for third single. And so somehow one of those stupid songs from Next Door, which is that, you know, Till We Die or whatever. It's not even Joey playing drums. It's not a stupid song. It's a good song. I don't think it fits in the vein of what we were trying to do on that record.
Well, one second. Let me just kind of put things in perspective for people, because you and I may know something that someone listening might not know. And that is that simultaneously, while All Hope Is Gone is being recorded, Sean Crahan, Jim Root, Sid Wilson, they have like this experimental second recording session going on, which is known as Look Outside Your Window. And so what you're telling me, I think, is that at one point you thought that they were going to try to make Snuff one of their experimental songs.
It was on their board.
So what you're saying is that you were trying to keep it from that session, which, like you said, one of those songs kind of ends up on the like bonus edition of the album. And you brought it into the main record, the main recording session, because you had heard this demo from Corey and you were like, no, I don't want to lose this song. This needs to make the record. Is
I
that
want
right?
this song on the fucking record, like to make sure it actually was something that I could put my stamp on and make it what it is today. I don't think they ever would have built it out like I did. There's no way. There's no way. So we get down to where the third single is going to come out. And they wanted to use Till We Die. And I'm like, I mean, I said, well, fuck, you know, and I was emailing with Monty. I'm like, I don't understand. Like, why wouldn't you want to release Snuff? I mean, that's just insane. And so, blah, blah, blah. A couple of weeks pass again. And then I get a fucking email that says, holy shit, dude, you were right. We tested Snuff. It's a fucking smash. So they came out with it. And of course, it went number one and all that crap. That's some of the dynamics you have to deal with when you believe in something. I mean, that, you know, there was another one similar to that that happened on Mudvayne with the A&R department. Did not want to lead with Happy. I'm like, wait, or that was their fucking manager at the time, didn't want to lead with Happy. Like, I'm like, dude, we got to put our fucking foot down here. Like, best song, we should put it out now. That fucking song's got to hit radio, because I knew that thing was a fucking smash hit. I knew it from the demo, man. I was like, holy fuck, that song. But, you know, so the similar, these things happen all the time. And it's my job even to go against the A&R department sometimes, if I got to fucking stand up for some shit, you know, which the way it goes. Your original question. Okay. So I get all these demos. And this is like what I think I'm going to do to it. Right. Well, there really weren't any, there was no lyrics on them yet, but I knew I had the core of the music was fantastic. So really, really it's just arrangements, maybe additional things we'd put on it. And for the rest of the track, Snuff's the only one that I really did a production sort of, you know, whole thing on it. So the other things, like there's no lyrics on it. We get there. Then I got to, you know, we're really just, I'm waiting to see whatever Corey's going to do. And that's another great thing. A good lesson to other producers is sometimes it is your job to realize when it's fantastic and just get the fuck out of the way. And, you know, I mean, Jeremy Parker, my Pro Tools guy, I can tell you too. I mean, Jesus Christ. We worked with Amy, and she's one of the greatest singers I've ever known, right? Amy Lee. But still, we went through and through and through, and there was lines that weren't working. You know, we probably did the outro line of My Immortal. You know, I've been alone all these years. That goes into the solo section or whatever. I mean, there must have been 40 takes of that thing. We would come back and revisit it every few weeks and until it was like, that's it, we finally got it. It just wasn't sounding that great. But Corey Taylor, however, then gets on the mic with the songs that he knows, and I'm like, God damn, dude, we would just do 3 takes of it. And I told him, I said, look, you know, I don't want to seem like I'm not trying to help you, but I don't think there's a fucking thing wrong with that at all. Like, we could just pick any one of them. So he would just be like, all right, give me verse 1 here. Give me the bridge here. But that was the case. I mean, Snuff is it's one take, that lead vocal. He just sang it, dude. It's one take. It's the only band that I have never turned on any sort of tuning for. Like, that dude is just that good. I mean, there's just no way around it. That fucking guy. And so, you know, even, you know, they get on, I think it was on VH1 or something. And this is what you have to go through in order to ensure that you've got the right thing is you're risking the fact that normally I'm the guy that's in there coaching through every fucking note of everything. So in this one instance, it can lead them to think, well, I don't know what he does, because most producers tortured him, I think. I don't really know. Which, that doesn't matter at all. You hear the fire, you leave the fire alone, man. It fucking was on. And so I saw an interview later. And they're like, so what did you know? Well, you know, what did Dave Fortman really teach you bringing to the table? He didn't really know what to say. He's just like, he taught me kind of how to get the sound right there and then. Because that's at that point, you know, other than arranging building the Frankenstein song that Snuff is, you know, I don't blame him. There's nothing you can say, because I didn't really have to produce that guy a whole lot vocally. He every time he would sing, I'd be like you get afraid to want to fuck with it. When you would keep doing things over, then you may never find that again. You know, it was that good, man. And so you're listening to a one take on Snuff for one, and then we added doubles. But that's just a run through. I mean, the guy just sang it out, and he's just like, nope, that's perfect. But I'm like, yeah, I fucking agree. That's great.
Well, especially a song like that that's so emotional, like you said, you don't want to lose that that quality to it. So that makes sense to me, versus maybe just like yelling.
And he's just so good at that shit, man. You know, and like Gematria, I mean, you look at how fucking gnarly that. I mean. Man. All those songs, both were so mean, man. I was like, damn, dude, his throat gets all big. I was freaked. I looked at my fucking Pro Tools guy. I'm like, God, dude, what the fuck have we? Look what we just. What have we landed right now? We're fucking sitting on a fucking monster, man. It was badass to watch him perform. It really was. Same with Joey. Joey was the kind of guy. He's just a fucking, like a 13-year-old fucking rock kid, that kind of brain. He's just like, fuck everybody, man. You know, just, and like he wrote the All Hope Is Gone riff. I mean, he wrote Psychosocial's riff. He wrote Duality with the one from Rick Rubin. The same exact arrangement, same exact music, all written in his mom's basement. And then Corey wrote the vocal. That's how fucking talented that guy is. All those fucking legendaries with riffs. You know, came out of Joey, most of them. And you have some really cool stuff this album that obviously Jim had a couple sulfurs really great. And Jim, when he gets locked in, is really, I mean, he's a really cool lead tone. And just all of, I mean, these guys are some talented motherfuckers, man, the whole batch of them. Mick on guitar, I mean, all of it. Sean, too, man, his level of creativity when it comes down to, you know, overdubbing things. Like, we did snare drum overdubs on Psychosocial. And so I just let him kind of have his thing, and it really came out great, man, with just a little bit of guidance. But in the past, you know, they had, you know, with Ross, the story was that they, you know, they would tape the windows off, and then their Joey would redo a lot of the stuff that was going on percussion wise. But I felt like, you know, this would be a good chance to set everything up, just start beating on shit, whatever they want to beat on. And it was in the snare drum thing, I think, was one of my favorite moments, you know. I mean, it's not, and now people are kind of, they've copied that a few times, man.
You're talking about that snare drum fill during kind of like the breakdown of Psychosocial?
Yeah, that whole thing, yeah. That's now showed up. There is a direct copy of the new Papa Roach song. Direct copy of that. And maybe with a little bit of Psychosocial mixed in. You can just hear them. I mean, whoever wrote it is just using that same, the same beat, like same everything. It's on there, you know. And I forget, it was a couple of years ago, another song came out, and I'm like, Psychosocial. They use the same attack snare kind of breakdown. So I consider that to be a fucking massively original moment. You know, I knew it when I was like, holy fuck, all right, that is badass, man. So I, you know, I had a, even though those guys, you know, him and Jim, like, because of the whole thing next door, they were, you know, they were at a feud between Joey and everything. So I took the brunt of that. But then they kind of came back later and realized that it was mostly Joey, and I wasn't going to switch sides. You know, I was fully involved with Joey. I was become really tight with him. I love the songs that he had, and they are the core songwriters of the band from the historical success. I didn't have enough time. I didn't feel like to abandon that at all. I need to nurture that 100%. And even if it meant losing these dudes, and they had a meeting, tried to fire me, and didn't happen because Corey and I think Joey were like, now this is like, this guy can, they're like, he can't handle the pressure, man. You know, because they were mad because I'm trying to, they were in a place where everybody's separated, you know, and they're all dealing with individual problems, partying or whatever they're doing. And so I didn't realize, I mean, they should have fucking spoke up early on. They wanted to, like, two of them wanted to get in with Jim, you know, Jim and Sean. I think they just really wanted, we recorded the drums with just Joey. Because me and Joey, it was hard to get people out there to come do it. And Joey was ready to go. And so we kept listening. We're like, damn, he's the guy who wrote most of the songs. He could just play it. And that was fine. And I had Jim and Sean sign off on it and listen. And they're like, well, yeah, it sounds killer. And then so that all changed. And they start turning around on me when Jim was playing guitar. Like, one breakdown didn't fit right or whatever. So they got mad because I was going to move the drum. You know, and they're like, Then this whole thing started against me. So that part was the most difficult part of it, you know, was I'm having to deal with two different camps, one of which now can't stand me or whatever, but they think I'm a nice guy. So they're still hanging in there. And then you have these moments where you realize this is something way before me, you know, like half the songs that were on the demo. I mean, Sean come in and play on them. And he would be sitting there going, oh, that's a really cool song. I'm like, but you never heard the demo? You've had this demo for like 2 months, man. Like, not even willing to entertain Joey's songs anymore. You know, like, just not even feeling like they wanted to be an influential part of the writing process. And then this is what happens with bands when you have a few members writing most of the history. And then you have a lot more band members. Everybody now is at a success level of doing sheds around the world. It's totally natural. You know, I have no bad feelings towards those dudes. I had a great time with them in the studio. I don't know if they forgot that part, but we had a blast recording. And they are two talented motherfuckers, man. And, you know, all that shit Sean did is legendary. All that percussion stuff. Jim, too. Jim's a phenomenal motherfucking guitar player, man. I mean, his leads and all everything, you know. And they're great people. They really are. But that's some of the turmoil that you can see when you get that many people sort of involved.
There's nine people, no matter what. It's going to be hard to get nine people on the same page, I would imagine. And this record's also known for being like the most collaborative between all nine. So you must have been able to diplomatically kind of wrangle between those two camps. I know you said you're kind of more loyal to one, which makes sense. Yeah. Joey's the one that hired you, so you're going to be like, well, I'm going to go with that guy. But at the same time, it must have all, I mean, we know it all came together because we have this record to show for it. But I can understand that. You had those conflicts and things like that. And then, I mean, you kind of alluded to it earlier, but Jim does have, he's the main songwriter on Sulfur, right? Which is a big song on the record.
That's a big one. Yeah. Him and Joey got together and pulled that off, which is a good one. I love that song. Yeah. The Butcher Silk. Yeah. I believe that's also Jim's writing. And look, I don't mind if other writing, but but some of the stuff that was happening next door, it was just so different than it was Pink Floyd-y kind of stuff. And I wouldn't have minded entertaining it, but they didn't want Joey to play on it, which is really bizarre, you know? And I was telling them, you know, Joey's not even on this stuff. I mean, like, this is almost, seems to me that it'd be a waste of time because he's going to have a say so about it in the end, right? To put it on the record. So there, you know, some kind of weird times like that, but overall, you know, I was in amazement of these people. All of them, you know, especially the core writers, you know, and Paul, he's the guy that's written all the sort of the dark, like Dead Memories. That's Paul. I mean, what a beautiful song, man. This guy had a knack for fucking writing that kind of stuff. I mean, him and Joey, their demos, man, to me were fantastic. I was like, holy shit, dude, I'm gonna make this fucking rad.
And well, you said that the demo doesn't have any vocals on it, so are you guys recording the music and then they're collaborating with Corey as to like kind of the direction that the songs are going to go in? Because not all of them are, you know, like the opening song was like all screaming, and then you have Sulfur that's kind of a mix between the two. Dead Memories you just referenced is almost like completely singing. So like, how do they kind of come up with what the tone is going to be vocally?
Oh, well, he had been writing. So he had a bunch of stuff done, and he came out, I believe, and sang it, you know, in pre-pro. We were over at Paul's house in his little downstairs jam room. And I believe, if I remember correctly, which is now a long time ago, he came over and he sang some of the ideas. But, you know, one thing about this band, which I respect the shit out of, and I've never seen it in any other man in my fucking life ever, is that they don't micromanage each other at all. And this, I find this really bizarre and cool as fuck. They're so confident in what they do. Like, nobody policed any single part of anybody else's parts. And which is really bizarre is in the mixdown, only me and Joey and Monty Connor policed the mixes. Like first mix, it came from Colin Richardson over in England. I was blown away. I mean, I played, you know, every single band member I played for, they're just like, oh yeah, cool, sounds great. And then me and Joey would have to go doctor and to get it into the sound it is now, you know, which it took a lot of work. I thought he was vastly on the wrong page, and Joey wanted me to do it after I heard the first mix. At the time I was in love and I already had plans to like go to this island with what is now the mother of one of my children. And so I really didn't. I was like, oh shit, man. You know, I don't want to do this. So I fucking called Colin and told him, all right, go read what Sean just said about the record. And like Sean came out with this like violent description of what we're doing, you know, which is great. And I said, look, this band can't have, it's not pretty. It's got to sound like there's something wrong with it. Like it's, everything should be in a lower type of bite. Like you got to like go, you know, on the vocal, don't put 12K, go put 4K. It's all, you know, snare drum. Don't make it, there's no top pretty shit on any of this stuff. It's all bite, pissed, mad guitar tones. Wait, come on down to like 2K instead of like five, you know. And so that, then he kind of understood what the fuck I was talking about. You know, it's the wrecking ball theory. It's got to be this, you know, like Bob Clearmountain had that description one time of how a punk band told him, you know, we don't, none of the outside pretty shit, all spiked wrecking ball, you know, fucking steel ball with spikes. It needs to kill you. And so I said, go listen to the other ones sound like that. You know, like just, so it's got to be Slipknot. You got to make it something gnarly or Joey's going to make me stay here and fucking do it. You know, Joey was like, cause the roughs already sounded really good. And Joey's like, oh man, we already got it. You got to stay. And like, I don't know, dude, let me talk to Colin. And so then Colin came back with an entirely different take on it. And it was fabulous. I was like, that's exactly what the fuck we're talking about. And then Joey's all, yep, there it is. So then at that stage, you have no other fucking band member wanting to check mixes out, which I find fascinating that they're that confident and, you know, just nonchalant about something so fucking important, you know, which gives them creative freedom too, man. Like nobody's judging, you know, normal little tiny things maybe here and there, you know, and then I remember, you know, the few things where, but it didn't change though. Oh no, Sulfur, of course, that, you know, was, you know, Jim had finally gotten a song in one of the records that was primarily his. And so I remember, yeah, he was kind of weirded out on the note, the actual Sulfur note. You know, and so but then Corey still never changed. He's just like, nah, it totally works. And it does, but I think it's like the only time I can remember anyone, no one ever came in and being all like, nah, man, you should be more like this, you know, or it should be like this other part. Yeah, there's no micromanagement going on in that band, at least not on the record I was on. Those motherfuckers are, even though they were so separated in their lives, they were, you know, in the end, if you look at their reactions to what we were doing in part wise, like they're just come in and be like, cool, fuck yeah. You know, it was pretty rad in that sense, you know. It was a tripped out record to make.
What was the first song that you guys tracked for this record?
We'll be back after a quick break.
You still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game. Yeah. Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there. We all artists, man. We gonna have this like,
bro, me and my man Kai, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gonna lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it, take that shit serious.
Oh, I think it was Gematria, I believe. Oh my God. I don't know. Yeah, we had, because we were dicking around and Joey loved the drum sounds, you know. He was like, holy fucks, best my drums ever sounded, blah, blah, blah. And we're going to, and so he just started cut, he started doing stuff. He's like, man, just let me see if I can just cut one of them. Because we were having a hard time getting anyone to come out to the studio, you know, and that went on the entire process, you know, like people not showing up, whatever. And so eventually, and I, you know, had gone and asked permission. I said, dude, I said, Sean, you know, come check this out. I mean, Joey cut this. I mean, can we use it? And there, and both him and Jim listened individually, and both were like, yeah, go for it. So we did. And it's what you hear right now on the album. It's fantastic because I've done that before. It's not like, you know, you miss a little bit of push and pull if they played it live? Or does anybody really fucking know the difference? Not many people would, you know. It's either got a great hook, you know, and it's still Joey playing the song he wrote. So I think they realize that, especially after the success of it, you know.
Are you saying that Joey played guitar on the song?
Nah, he played the drums without any band playing along with him.
Oh, okay. That's crazy, right? Isn't there normally like a scratch track or something going?
Yeah, no, not this one. It's fucking... Because we fucking cut the, I mean, we was in there, nobody around. Fuck. We're calling him, you know, we tried to call two or three people they'd come track, but you know, you couldn't get anybody to come out of the studio because they were, I don't know what they were fucking doing. But it was difficult. So then they start to come back later, and you know, now they get motivated. But then, and Joey's like, no, fuck that. Because they had me cornered at one point, and they were, you know, they're like, man, Joey needs his band, man. You know, this is not Slipknot, man. I said, all right, cool. I'll talk to him, you know. So I call him, and he's like, fuck that shit. Tell him if I'm redoing my drums, I'm pulling all the songs, and I quit the fucking band. And I was like, all right, there you have it. Now, I could have, you know, we already had those tracks recorded. You know, I realize now, you know, I'm much older and more diplomatic even than I was then, you know. But I realize now, I could have approached Joey differently and just said, hey, you know, it's feeling kind of stale. Let's try one track with the whole band. And then that would have led to them doing the whole album that way. So that was kind of the only fuck up I really think of in that whole session, really was that one thing in order to make, because it would have made them really happy. I would have never had the backlash in the internet from Jim and Sean, which lasted for years before they came back around and Revolver and kind of took it all back. But that would have never happened had I just had the one conversation with Joey in a different way. So I wasn't thinking properly to go and just tell Joey, hey man, you know, I should have said it was my opinion. You know, I should have said, look, this shit just feels disjointed. This is what I would do this now and present it to him. And he would have been like, ah, no worries, man. Let's try it with the band. You know, let's get everybody set up. Let's fucking do it. So, you know, in the end, you know, we had the per capita, the most successful run of the band's history. We look at overall numbers and over, not the, well, not sales, but I'm talking about during a time before, even before streaming got giant, when nobody was buying records, we still came out, sold a million records, still went number one on Billboard. And the success of those singles launched them into a new level for sure, you know.
Well, Gematria, I wanted to talk about that. And also, Gematria is like this insane song to open a record with in a good way. Like, it's just this monster where they sound like they're closer to Metallica than they are to, you know, whatever they were before. Because they're coming off this record with Rick Rubin that was borderline their outspoken attempt at kind of being like a pop rock band, you know, and still being Slipknot. So to open the record with that song, which is this violent 6-minute attack, it's just riff city. It's got all sorts of crazy things going on with it. So, and if you're saying, I know you're saying you're not positive that that's the first song, but you definitely heard that song at some point. So when you are hearing this, you know, is that the direction you think that the whole record is going to go in? Because it sets that whole opening sequence of that Sulfur, Psychosocial. I mean, that's just like a freight train just running you over. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The demos, I don't know if they were lined up exactly like they are on the, now they, well, they couldn't have been, but yeah, that was first in the demo. It had always been Joey's idea to have that be the opening, because that drum intro thing that goes around in circles. I heard that and I was like, damn, on the demo. I was like, fuck yeah, dude. And then Psychosocial came on the demo and I'm like, oh, this is a fucking hit for sure. You know, not a whole lot of work to be done there, man. We just had to come up with, we did all the snare overdubs and tickled it. And then I heard Dead Memories and I'm like, damn, man, this is no bullshit. This fucking band's got some songs. This is even before I heard Corey's fucking genius on top of it all. And then I get out there, you know, so then I'm like, wow, this, when I heard Snuff in Corey's kitchen on GarageBand, I was like, okay, this has got some serious depth to it, man. Like this, like, just imagine how gnarly that is from. And I forget what other heavy songs were on the demos, but the, you know, a bunch of them. I don't think Sulfur wasn't on there. They wrote that during the record, I believe. But yeah, I was like, damn, you know. But yeah, Gematria didn't throw me to think that that was the direction. It only took me to get to Psychosocial to realize that it's going to be a diversified record, you know. Because if, I mean, but it all works together, which is nuts.
Yeah, I mean,
he started fucking yelling, burn your cities. And I was like, God damn. America. I was getting the chills in the studio, like, geez, that dude's throat's about to explode, and he's just blasting out his voice. And he's on a U 47, right? And that's a real, like, Chad from Mudvayne, you know, for his heavy stuff, you know, 58s, even Phil Anselmo, they all use 58s, so give you a heavier kind of bite. But Corey could actually do heavy stuff on a 47, which is really bizarre. I've never seen anybody do it. And I didn't want to change microphones because it just sounded fucking rad. We would do the 58, you know, with a bunch of distortion on it for other parts. But his main vocal, like in Gematria, God, it's relentless. I mean, it's insane.
And yeah, the first time you're hearing the vocals is when he's tracking it, right? Because you heard these demos without.
Yeah, he sang a bunch in, we did like pre-pro or whatever.
Okay.
So everybody kind of wanted to hear what he had, you know, and he was stoked on all the lyrics he'd written. So he was singing through a bunch of parts for us. And so I had a general idea what's going on, but not a lot. But I couldn't get my head wrapped around it just because we didn't do that many pre-pro sessions like that. You know, it wasn't like we demoed the vocals and wanted to hear them. And then you have things like the title track of the record that came about. And I shit you not, man. I will not embellish. This is a real story. Like Joey writes it. Me and him drinking Coors. He showed me this riff. And him and Craig had come up with, like, whatever, getting Craig all these sounds, everything. So he fucking came in there, showed me that. And I'm like, God damn, man. Badass, right? So I had Mick lace some guitars one day. And so then I go to do vocals on it. And Corey had, I don't think he, I mean, if I can remember correctly, didn't have anything written on it. I'm pretty sure he came in, listened to it, and he's like, yeah, I got this, man. And so he's really hurrying up. He's got to go get his kid at like 5 or something. It was like 4:15 in the afternoon. This motherfucker's got to leave in like a half hour. And so he's viciously writing away, you know. He may have had some lyrics. That part I'm not 100% on, but I do know that he sang the whole fucking song in like 20 minutes, man. Game over, man. It was over. And he was saying he got out of there, went and picked his kid up, done. I mean, that's how fast that thing came together.
That's crazy. So they were still writing songs in the studio with you.
Yeah, because what happened was now you have this battle between Studio B. So every time that, like, you know, and it made Jim really mad for sure. I mean, Jim came in and he was upset about it. You know, like, he got, because for one, the riff is really hard to fucking play. And so I kept telling him it, you know, I wasn't trying to be a dick, but it just wasn't, it's not tight enough, you know? So I had to get Mick to come in and do it. Cause Jim got angry, stormed out of the fucking room. He's like, you know, that's what I think about Joey's fucking songs. I threw his guitar down. So I threw his Telecaster on the floor. And I'm like, holy fuck. So what had happened is that he knew, because every time they would come up with some shit over there, Joey would just come in and write another fucking song. You know, and he could do it in 30 minutes. And it turns out to be the title track of the record. And so there was one, at one point, Roadrunner had come out to the studio. And they said, they just decided on the song All Hope Is Gone being the title track of the record. I said, do you want to come play on it now? Or, I mean, he's like, fuck. Right, yeah, I guess so. And so he came in and put some overdubs or something down. But the main riff of that, the only person, not even Joey could play it. The only person who could play that is Mick. You know, I heard what Joey had written, but I couldn't get it out of Jim. But when Mick came in, he's a lot faster down picker. And so he's super chunky perfection, like, ultra rhythm player guy, but he was able to pull it off really great. And I said, well, let's just leave those things as the stereo guitars. And so I got Jim to come in and do some overdubs on it, at least to be on the track. I said, look, you know, there's no getting out of this, really. It's just, you know, record company loves it. They want that to be the title. I mean, that's like, if I forget, but wasn't it like the teaser song for the whole record? All Hope Is Gone was the first thing to ever come out. Yeah, so I remember that part. Yeah, they were sold that should be the first. And so that you know, just me delivering more bad news to the people that wanted their music from Studio B. And then here we go with Joey coming in and just kept writing more.
So you're saying that song was kind of written in response to try to counteract the material that was being built up on the other session so that it didn't mix, so that he could just kind of...
For sure. That's exactly what's going on. That's how badass Joey was. Yeah. It's like he's, you know, and that's a lot of, I mean, that's primarily, I don't know, man, I'm sure it had something to do with his partying or whatever, but he's, you know, there's a reason I only talk to one dude. There's a reason he's written all the, you know, all the hits. Duality, that's the biggest song they've ever had, right? Bigger than anything I did on my record, but my singles combined outdo that record competitively at radio, right? Especially in a time of no streaming. So that guy's, he had a lot of, I mean, he was one of the main, obviously one of the main people, one of the deciding factors of a lot of stuff. And there are only, I don't know about now, but at the time, you know, this is a lot of why they had enough of him. There was only four people on the record deal out of the nine. You know, it's not something most people know, but it was only Joey, Paul, Sean, and Corey were signed to Roadrunner. So you have this competitive outside thing to where they want to become members of the company, I'm assuming, you know. And so then the one way to get into that is to be a writer, you know. And I mean, Sid, I mean, that guy, know the whole story. I mean, God, I got, another guy where I never heard any of the demos. Coming in, just doing shit. And I'm like, all right. He's like, oh, that's a cool song. I'm like, wow. Yeah, you never heard that song before? Fucking. This is how much these people were, you know, on their own island at times, you know. And that guy hadn't been in the actual studio where I was actually working most of the fucking time. And he has the balls to go on VH1. And they're like, well, how was it working with Dave Fortman? He's like, I don't know. He didn't really do anything. Really? Fuck. On national television. I mean, think how I feel in that moment, knowing how little this guy was even on the record, like in mentally even involved with his own band, the people that actually got him to where he fucking is so he can have a house in Venice or wherever the fuck he lives. And that really made me fucking mad. I was like, wow, what a disrespectful fucking weirdo. Like, God, to say that kind of shit heading into a number one record that'll sell you a million copies. Unbelievable, that guy. But
well, I do want to ask a question about him in a second, but I want to go back to when you said that Roadrunner was coming out to the studio to kind of check in and they decided that's going to be the title track and everything.
Yeah.
Who is it that's coming out? Is it Monty Connor?
Yeah, Monty came out.
Jonas?
Yeah, Jonas came out. Lovely human being. I loved him. He was really cool. Yeah, and they were digging it, man. It took them a minute because they were kind of looking for that old school slip. I remember at least maybe there was two different times.
Dave Rath would have been around
that
time.
Dave Rath came out.
Okay.
Yeah, he's cool as fuck. I love him. I think it was him and like Monty came out first. Yeah, it might have been two different times. And they were just to see just check out what's going on. You know, it took them a minute, but then they started to kind of get it. And they're like, oh, okay. You know, and then.
Were they who recommended Colin Richardson be the mixer, or was that something the band wanted?
No, what had happened was Joey, they had used Colin on a live thing. And of course, you know, I love Colin's work. So I was like, yeah, that fucking sounds great. You know, and certainly I didn't want to, you know, if that's their suggestion, no, I'm not going to be all, oh, I want to mix it, you know? So yeah, no, it's just that he had done, Joey really liked what he did with some live thing that they did. And so I went, you know, when I'd known his work, Bullet for My Valentine, I really loved that record. And I'm like, yeah, fuck, let's do it. That guy's really talented. And he's a gentleman, just such a lovely gentleman, man, Colin. And so anybody that's willing to go the extra mile. And I, you know, and I do enjoy remaining the producer as another mixer is doing it. Therefore, I can then guide it from my ear without having to get burnt into the actual mix itself, which I sometimes believe I should have done that my entire fucking career. Because I'm way more powerful on a fresh ear telling somebody else what could happen and get the vision out of this album. Although my mix has sold shitloads of records, but I do enjoy that. So it was really cool because Monty has a great ear too, man. I mean, he's by far out of any A&R person I've ever fucking worked with. He has the best ear to understand like small, minute things that are happening in mixes. You know, he's an incredible dude too, man. Love that guy. You know, me, him and Joey went in a triangle of figuring out incrementally, even through mastering too, trying different versions, you know, and having Ted Jensen go with like a guitar up or whatever. I forget the different ones we would do, but man, the outcome of it is, I think, funner for me if I'm not actually the guy under the fucking gun mixing it.
Like you mentioned, All Hope Is Gone is kind of the first sampler of the record, but the song that's like presented as like this is the album with the music video and everything is Psychosocial, which to this day, of course, still one of their bigger songs. And it's an insane song. I mean, that like almost like 80s stadium rock chorus and then that insane breakdown. Yeah. And then we kind of talked about that snare drum fill in. So where does that idea even come from? Did it always have those two breakdowns like as the bridge and the outro? And what do you remember about that track?
Yeah, that fucking breakdown had Joey doing the shit on the snare drum. I believe it was like it was. Yeah. And we just went and added stuff to it, you know. Tom hits dun 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 dun, shack, with marching snares overdubbed. Probably, I don't know, 10 of them or something. But I think that's what happened. And then me and Joey went in and made sure we had all the proper, like, got the keg hits on snare sound. And he took these giant chains and would drop them on the floor. And we recorded clash, clash. And that's part of the sound, too. So you hear that being, you know, then we'd go put it in where the snare drum hits every time. So that's how you got the industrial sound out of it. But yeah, that there wasn't a whole lot to do to that. I don't even know if it needed any arrangement changes. I think it was me and Corey that would cut stuff out once he would get a vocal down. Then we could, because then it was the first time we could, in some of the songs, yeah, he, and plus I'd only heard him a few times live and not even whole pieces of them. So that one, I don't remember, but me and Corey would go like, all right, that's way too fucking long. Once he had a vocal and we just cut that whole thing out right there. And nobody gave a shit, you know, like Joey didn't give a fuck. I mean, if, you know, he's just like, do whatever you got to do, make the vocal work. But yeah, that song, yes, mostly just overdubbing the right shit on it. You know, we just went in there and fucking knocked it out. And I don't even know put a harmony on the vocal. I mean, the choruses, it's pretty simple. I mean, it really was a hit, kind of like it is. The same way he did Duality, pretty much what happened on Psychosocial. The guy just wrote a badass fucking song. He did this. He just wrote this fucking sick ass fucking song. I mean, that's all it really comes down to. One dude wrote this fucking badass song.
And those, like, for lack of a better word, gang vocals, like the chanting of Psychosocial and stuff, who all is doing those and how are you tracking that?
Those guys would go in there, man, that, you know, and just yell, you know, Psychosocial. We get three or four guys together, you know. I forget. I got some fucking old school video. I don't know. It's like whoever's there, really. I think it, you know, if I got video, I believe, or pictures of them. It's like Paul and Sean and Corey yelling together. It'd be something like that, you know. And if, I mean, Fane might have been around and yelling. Whoever was available to get out there and yell. And that's how it would come about. Yeah. Just real simple shit. Three dudes around a microphone. And do, you know, multiple takes of it, so it sounds like a chant. Ready for the time of your life has that same kind of shit, right?
Because we got like, the haze in the back.
Yeah, the hay, yeah. That's probably I think the picture or video I got is like them go, hey, hey, and it's like three dudes or something.
And then the song Guyana, which I think is how you say it, but you know what I'm talking about. That's one of the most interesting songs on the record for me, because as much as Snuff is completely different from everything else on the record, we have kind of heard Corey do things like that with Stone Sour at that point.
Yeah.
But the song Guyana is almost like, almost sounds like Queens of the Stone Age or something, like on the chorus. It's got this very like stonery, bluesy vibe to it. And I just thought that was, but like you kind of mentioned before, it all fits. Like it doesn't feel
It works out. Yeah, that's a Paul song. Paul wrote that whole song.
Okay.
Yeah, which I, you know, we would go over it in pre-pro. I was like, oh boy, this, whew, this one sleepy, long fucking song. But then after a while, yeah, once we got to record, I think we cut some of it out too. It was longer than that originally, I believe. And then once Corey got a vocal on it, I think me and him cut some of it out, some of the 4-8 bars or something out at some point in that. Yeah. Then I was like, all right, because it was really long. I was like, I remember looking over at Mick just with his head down, just kind of like taking a nap playing guitar on that song. And I would, sometimes it takes that long to even hear it being something to even like, but I right. do like it after all, you know.
Yeah, that was definitely a grower for me when I first got the record. I remember just even like you said, because it is so long, I was already like, oh, I'm kind of out. Like my attention span. But over time, it's that that kind of like
yeah.
chorus is really stuck.
I'd probably say, I mean, if I'm being honest, probably, I have to look at the track listing again, but that's probably my least favorite song that we worked on, for sure. Especially, you know, with Paul's ability to come up with Dead Memories, something so gorgeous. I think, you know, I just had this one regret. I probably could have pushed him to come up with something in the Dead Memories lane, you know, while we were working on the record. Just give me one more like that, you know, and instead of Gehenna. But he loved that song. I mean, if I remember correctly, I think I heard Paul outside talking to somebody like Jim or somebody talking about, yeah, man, I could totally be a single. And I'm like, what the fuck did I just hear? Are you kidding me, man? But that's, you know, that's what writers do. You know, I'm a writer. We all fucking think it's the raddest till it's not. It doesn't kill the record, but it's a slow beast, man.
Well, luckily, it's kind of halfway between it, too. So it almost like separates the two halves. Yeah. It's like in the perfect sequencing mm-hmm. of it. Is there a song that you feel like is the most collaborative between all 9 members on the album?
It's pretty much the same pattern. They're only it's Joey. It's Paul on Gehenna, Dead Memories. Joey and Paul kind of collaborating on a couple of other ones. But Psychosocial, Snuffs, obviously, Corey. Because I was there. For the full collaboration, I mean, I don't think there's really such thing, and not on that record, to where it's just whatever they overdubbed, you know. And that's like saying, well, every song's, I think, got somebody, everybody on there. We try to put everybody on every song, and if even it's just a fucking, you know, like Craig hitting a fucking ding or a pow, you know. Like anything, just, you know, it was a point in time. You know, because Craig's the raddest dude I've ever met. He's, you know, he's just kind of a quiet dude, likes to drink, and he's chilling out. And so I'm sure Joey's like, yeah, man, we got to get Craig on the record. So we just start working on his parts upstairs. So he would come in with like a fucking sound thing and be all, yeah. And he's like, you know, and Joey knew he just needs to get him on there without changing whatever we got going on. So it'd just be some fucking noise, and Craig would just push it and go, or something. That dude, I love that guy. Craig is the master. But yeah, so collaboration wise, now I would say that it went the same way the whole time.
Well, we've talked ad nauseum about Joey, and he deserves to be talked about. So I'm not saying that in a negative way. And we've talked about Corey, and you kind of mentioned how Sean is a very creative guy.
Yeah.
We talked about how Paul has contributed to the songs, and Jim, you know, has sulfur. Mick is a skilled guitar player, and he's able to translate the songs that Joey writes. Craig can make the boom sound. So that leaves us with, can you tell me things about recording Sid, who I know you mentioned before is absent, and then also Chris, you know, what are contributions they have? Even
Spain. Well, by far, my favorite human, like just hang out kind of funny is Fane out of them all. You know, I fucking fell in love with that guy. God damn, that dude's so fucking great. And so, yeah, Fane was also involved in the production, in percussion as well. He's one of the players. So, yeah, there was tons of stuff where I believe even in the snare parts, he played some of those. Like, there was both of them out there. We had a whole thing rig set up for him to play on. But, yeah, he's all in there, man, with all tons of shit, you know, like they're both in there beating on all kinds of crap, man. You know, no doubt. And we, you know, and they had a blast, man. Both of them did doing it. And then, Sid did some really wonderful shit. I think the most amazing thing that he gave me was in Snuff, where he listened to Snuff, you know, and he goes, dun, 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 and he goes, bang, 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 on piano, right? And I was like, that is fucking genius, you know? And then, of course, all the scratching stuff and all that. I mean, he seems like a nice enough guy. I just was kind of weirded out by him saying I didn't do anything well on VH1. You know, but he was just in the camp of Studio B. So I never really got to know him. I barely saw him, you know, and I'm making a record next door and he certainly wasn't there. I don't remember him seeing him only when he came in to record stuff, really. That's about it, you know. And they did pull me aside and played me, you know, a bunch of songs. Like, I remember Clowns had an interview that, you know, we played 2-4 of 12 songs and he only thought 4 were worth the shit. But they wanted to, you know, like, I just, you know, like they wanted to have this intro that went into Gematria. It's like the intro in front of the intro, which the intro is the drum thing, right? And so, it was straight out of the wall. I mean, it was just straight up Pink Floyd. It was the same exact progression as one of the transitions in the wall. And I just told him, I'm not sure I'm feeling it. And so then they played to Joey and Joe's like, hell no. No way. That does not go in front of the intro. And so there was all these different types of moments. I thought independently on their own, excluding the record, that there's some brilliant stuff going on. Till We Die, great fucking song. It doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't match the album of what we were trying to work on. And so their, you know, their vision over there was that, you know, that album. And Sean, you know, once I got into about to leave to go to Des Moines, you know, I got on the phone with Sean because the manager said, you know, one of the members wants to talk to you outside of Joey. And so he was just trying to make sure that I was going to entertain. And I didn't really understand what he was talking about at the time, because I'm like, well, of course I would entertain any kind of music, because now I see what he's actually saying. But he was telling me, you know, the record that these guys always do, that's going to get made no matter what. We want to be more creative and have all this other stuff going on. And so I didn't really know to the extent of what that meant until later, when I realized, oh shit, like they want to do all these other fucking songs and have all these different things that they believe in on the record with the main writers. And that was a little frightening to me. I was like, you know, all right, well, let me hear what's going on. And I can't say that I didn't hear a single thing over there that I would have wanted to put in the vein of what we had going on next door.
So you flew out to Iowa, where they all live, to do this record. Is that something that you normally do, go to on location with the bands you're working with? Or do you have like a home studio that you typically have them come to you?
I did have a studio. But, you know, bands, man, when they're famous like that, Certainly, there are. They've been on the road. You know, they're trying to. It's much better for them to be around. So they, because you know, you finish a record, then what do you got to do? You got to go back on the road. So when are you home? You're never going to be fucking home. You know. So I understood that. That happened. You know, same thing with Simple Plan, man. Where, you know, I built this studio. But when I built the studio in Louisiana, I thought because I'd done Evanescence, there would be a bunch of new bands coming through. But, you know, my hand got played differently to where suddenly I got brought in to continue careers rather than stardom, which is a much more serious fucking job to do. You know, here's a bunch of guys that have 3 gold records, you know, like Mudvayne, like, all right. And so that job is way different where, you know, Mudvayne, they were willing to travel. Simple Plan, however, not a chance in hell. I mean, they wanted to be in Quebec, in Montreal, where they're from. Same with Slipknot, you know, you talk about it for a minute and they're like, nah, you know, like they're not going to come to Louisiana away from their families for, you know, 4 months when they've been on the road and all this, you know, and I understood that. And certainly, yeah, with established bands, yeah. A lot of them are not hometowns, but at least central locations where they'd love to be.
Did you and Sean ever bond over the Mudvayne connection you guys have? Or do you even know that they like were?
Yeah,
all
well, you know, Matt, I'm still good friends with the Mudvayne guys, but, you know, but Matt had told me about it. But I, you know, that just never came up. You know, Sean was in a space of having to deal with Joey and the independence of each member, and they, you know, they had gone off on different islands, and you know, and Joey had been through a couple of rotten phases, you know, of partying, man, and obviously Paul too. You know, Paul was telling people he was sober, but can't fool me. I'm from Louisiana, man. I got a lot of fucking friends that are fucking nuts. You know, been through it, seen it. So I knew what was going on. But the band, I don't think really did, most of them, you know. Unfortunate that it had to end like it did. And, you know, brilliant guy. I mean, came in and played some fucking great lines. The nicest motherfucker you ever met in your life, yeah. He's the most out of them all. The only dude that called me, I think, right away when the album went number one was Paul.
Well, that's a great segue into the penultimate question I have for you. So you mentioned kind of before where, you know, you were talking to Roadrunner about the single, like, oh, why aren't we going with Snuff as a single and things like that. You're kind of working with the mix. So in general, after you're done producing the record, how involved are you in the rest of the process? You know, like, are you a...
No, zero. I'm not involved in single choices or any of that stuff unless I find there's a massive problem. And then therefore I'll have to contact A&R because, you know, they leave you involved as much as when we're trying to get the record coming out, because obviously we're going to, you know, go through versions of whatever mixes and shit and edits or if anything's being edited. But in that one case, I had somehow gotten a heads up on them wanting to use Till We Die as the third single. And I was like, oh, fuck no. And I couldn't understand why that wouldn't be Snuff, you know. So
what about as far as like the album cover and things like that? Have you ever worked on an album and you're so psyched about it and then you see what they chose as the cover and you're like, oh no, we gotta, you've ruined all of our hard work.
Yeah, there was one tiny little album called Fallen.
Okay.
And they wanted to have the cover, the original artwork was the half of Amy's face was melted, kind of like Marilyn Manson, I believe. It was like this scary version. And I thought that was a fucking horrible idea, but I didn't even have to speak up. Everyone else spoke up before I could even say anything. But it was not good. It was because she's so pretty, you know, and like I was like, oh, they can't go with that. You know, it's just like taking Photoshop and melting the half of your face off. Was it the same picture that's on there now, but with the face melted off on the half side. So that, yeah, they quickly corrected that. I didn't have to say shit, but there, that's one time where I was like, I don't know. You know, this is fucking not good. So thank God they did something about it.
Well, finally, we've kind of talked about things that you would have done differently as far as maybe approaching Paul to contribute a little bit more because you loved what he did. And then also maybe just the way that you handled the Joey situation, maybe kind of tried to make it a more cohesive unit. Although I understand, I mean, it's easy to say looking back, but when you got people cornering you, you're going to be like, well, I'm not trying to make them happier. But regardless, we've talked about the things you would have done differently. What is something that you look back on? What's your favorite moment of making this record? What's something that really sticks out?
The moments that I got to spend with the main three guys that wrote all the history, you know, the true soul of what an incredibly fantastic thing it is to meet people that somehow have been just born to do this thing, to change the world. You know, and it's on such a large scale. And then you get to sit there and watch Joey do what he does, man, and like sit there and play in the riff to All Hope Is Gone when he's writing it. You know, him and Craig had come down from, Craig had another little kind of studio thing up there. He's all, dude, I got this riff, man. And it's just an energy. It's this glow about Joey that was so fucking real. And that's how people that some of that, you know, and I've never met someone that gnarly, you know. It's the same like Phil, man. When Phil walks into a room, I mean, there's just no doubt in it. This motherfucker is born to rule the world. Phil Anselmo. He's got that energy too. His is a different trip. His is, you know, he's a singer, more, he's whatever, but Joey's is just this fucking dude that it, oh my God. And so I thought that to look back on it, him and Corey, to be around those dudes in general and to have them know songs that my band did, you know, like Corey, the first day I showed up, we got out to the studio, he sang Goddamn Devil, like the verses, the choruses. I mean, he knew it. that happened. And then there are always the really great times, you know, long before they got mad and they were still in the war between them and Joey. There were times when I did get a chance to work with John, and he had a fucking fabulous time. Hearing Jim say, we just got the best tones. You know, what used to take us 3 weeks, we just got these tones in 3 hours. You know, so there was parts of it, engineering wise, because I'm fucking good at that kind of shit, where they were stoked, or we were just doing leads with Jim. Yeah, there are a lot of great times. He's a funny dude, man. We had a blast. I mean, it wasn't like we were mad in the fucking session. We were having a fucking blast. It was sort of the internal war that I got drug into because of a decision not to let the band, or decision just to let Joey have his drums done without the band playing. That's all it came down to. But as people, we had a blast individually recording with each other, you know, because I would have them one-on-one in the room with me, you know. And Mick, you know, I haven't said anything about him, but yeah, what a fabulous dude, you know, the gamer nerd. And he would do things in his little laugh, man. He fucking that guy, and he's so badass, man. Like, his rhythm is so fucking tight. Like, it's one of the greatest palm mute like down pickers I've ever worked with. But his energy, you know, and never showed up before 6 p.m. Like, that's, he's, you know, he's a gamer. I remember asking Mick one time, this was really great. I said, so what do you think tomorrow, man? Like 3? He's like, I don't know, dude. You know, just got the new, you know, whatever game it was. He goes, it's going to be a late night game. And we called it a session, I think. It'll be a late session, dude. So we'll see. Sure enough, 6 p.m. But yeah, those are some of the highlights. Obviously, some downtime with Corey was great. You know, he's a great dad. I remember sitting there, me and him watching Edward Scissorhands, his scissor hands, all drunk as fuck on his couch, eating nachos together. And he's just a fucking great guy. Little things like that matter to me. First of all, seeing the bright stars of the future and the past too at that point. I mean, they're just born to do it, man. They can't get around it. Some of the two of the most incredible, and Paul too. But I would say that Corey and Joey, as the core majority writers in what we call Slipknot, were by far the most electrifying human beings I've ever sat in a room with that had anything to fucking do with music.
Thank you so much to Dave for talking to us, and thank you for listening. As a reminder, you could have heard this in every episode, including bonus episodes early on patreon.com/meetmepod. Please support the show over there so I can continue to bring these to you and give us feedback. And I don't know who us is because it's just me, but give me, myself, and I feedback on Instagram at meetmepod. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Tell a friend, tell an enemy, tell a lover, make a lover, love another via the Meep Meep. In the meantime and in between time, my name is Ryan Rainbro. This is Meep Meep, and yes, that's the best that I could come up with. Bye!